Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
We are back. Thank you for listening. The number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. I got a message, very brief message via email, and it's, you know, why are they not putting holy water in the holy water fonts in my parish? All right. Well, they shouldn't do that. The holy water font in your parish should not have sand in it. It should not be empty of holy water. It should not have rocks. It should not have a little cactus in there. This is one of those trendy, goofy eccentricities that some people think in their misguided notions that is, this is somehow going to enhance your Lent, because it's a journey after all. And you're in the desert after all, and there's sand in the desert after all, none of which is true. So the first thing I'd like to do is share with you a response to this very question, a dubium that came out from, and this is going back 22 years, so in 2000, a priest asked the congregation for the sacraments and divine worship, and I think that was the particular department in the Vatican, whether or not it was okay to remove holy water in the fonts at church during Lent. So here's how the question was asked. Our Sunday bulletin states that holy water will be removed from Ash Wednesday on during Lent to remind us that we are in a desert. What is the latest ruling for removing holy water? It used to be done on Good Friday. So the answer that was given by the Congregation for Divine Worship says, this dicastery is able to respond that the removing of holy water from the fonts during the season of Lent is not permitted for two reasons. First, the liturgical legislation in force does not foresee this innovation, which in addition to being praeter legem, is contrary to a balanced understanding of the season of Lent, which, though truly being a season of penance, is also a season rich in the symbolism of water and baptism, constantly evoked by the liturgical texts. In other words, when you're at Mass during Lent, there's an abundance of reference to water and baptism in the readings, in the prayers at Mass, etc. The second reason that the Vatican gives as a no to this question, is it okay to remove the holy water from the fonts during Lent? No. Second reason why, the encouragement of the church that the faithful avail themselves frequently of her sacraments and sacramentals, keep in mind that holy water is not a sacrament, it's a sacramental, is to be understood to apply also to the season of Lent. The fast and abstinence which the faithful embrace in the season does not extend to abstaining from the sacraments or the sacramentals of the church. The practice of the church has been to empty the holy water fonts on the days of the sacred triduum in preparation for the blessing of the water at the Easter Vigil, and it corresponds to the days on which the Eucharist is not celebrated. That's Good Friday and Holy Saturday. You know, hoping that this resolves the question, with every good wish and kind regard, I am yours sincerely in Christ, etc., etc. So that's the official response. It's not the first time that it's happened. But this is an important thing for people to be aware of. So two commentaries, both brief, from my friend Father John Zuhlsdorf. He goes by the handle Father Z. His website is What Does the Prayer Really Say? Or at least those are the first letters of those words. If you're looking for his website, it's wdtprs.com. So just remember, What Does the Prayer Really Say? And it's the first letter of each of those words, wdtprs.com. So he says, one of these days, I'll tell you about a story about holy water in Lent, but he says that's another story. Holy water, he says, is the sacramental. We get the powerful theology of its use in the older ritual in the prayers for exorcism of the water and salt that's used in the blessing itself, and he gives a link to an article that he wrote about that. He says, holy water is a powerful weapon of the spiritual life against the attacks of the devil. You do believe in the existence of the enemy, right? You know you're a soldier and pilgrim in a dangerous world, right? So why would these dopey liturgists and remove a tool of spiritual warfare precisely during the season of Lent when we need it most? Holy water is a sacramental. It is for our benefit. It is not a toy. It's not something to be abstained from, like you might abstain from chocolate or television. And then in a separate commentary, in a different post, he says, where did it go? Actually, this is a little bit longer, and it's under the headline, Removing Holy Water from the Fonts During Lent, Grr, as in I'm angry. So I'll leave it at that. I think it's sufficient to know what he had to say on this topic. So the holy water should be there, except for Good Friday on. And that's because not because the church wants you to abstain from it, but because the church wants you to be in preparation for the new holy water that's being made. So there should not be sand, there should not be rocks, there should not be a little cactus or anything else in those holy water fonts during Lent except for holy water, nor should they be empty. So if you're interested and you might have need of that letter that came from the Vatican on this topic, Cyrus is going to post a link to this article from Father Z on the show feed, the show Twitter feed, at P Madrid Show. You can access it, and then that way you'll be able to speak intelligently if the issue should come up. Thank you. Let's go to Bernice now in Graham, Washington. Hello, Bernice.
Hi, how are you?
I am well, thank you.
Hello. Good. I wanted to ask you, it's not a quick question. I was speaking with some people, and there was a new church at a city where my friends live, and I saw three crosses, and it said Catholic Church, Coptic mm-hmm. Catholic Church.
Right.
And so I went in and I talked to the pastor there, and I told him that I was a Roman Catholic, and he says, oh, you're more than welcome to come in, and attend. He says, you cannot receive the Eucharist. And he spoke to me at length. And so my question then is, what churches, because he said that it was somebody of Antioch. I can't remember if it was Peter of Antioch or
Ignatius.
But he said there were several churches that were created by the apostles, and not all of the Catholic churches were created by St. Peter. So if Jesus gave the keys to St. Peter, are the churches that the other apostles founded, are they valid or not valid?
All right. That's a very good question. And the man is confused, at least as far as Christian history is concerned. First of all, keep in mind that the so-called Coptic Catholic Church is not the same thing as the Coptic Orthodox Church. And that goes all the way back to the Apostle to St. Mark, back in the time of the Apostles. So this church that calls itself the Coptic Catholic Church is actually just a branch of Anglicanism. It's just a branch of the Church of England. So it's not an ancient church. The Church of England is not an ancient church. It only goes back 500 years, and it broke away from the Catholic Church. So just as here in the United States, we have the Episcopal Church, that's the American branch, if you want to call it that, the American branch of the Church of England. Okay, so it's not an historic church. That's the first thing to know. And the polemic that you heard, first of all, you would do well. In fact, I would urge you, don't receive communion in that church because it's not even a valid Holy Eucharist. Because as Pope Leo XIII said in an encyclical that he wrote, maybe it wasn't an encyclical, maybe it was an apostolic letter. I have to go back and look. But about 125 years ago, he issued a magisterial statement on Anglican holy orders. Apostolicae Curae is the name of the document, in which he said that Anglican, and this would also extend to Episcopal and any other branches of the Church of England, that their holy orders are null and void. So the Catholic Church does not accept so-called Anglican holy orders as valid. So the Archbishop of Canterbury is just a layman. He's dressed like a bishop, but he's not a bishop. So from an objective standpoint, the church rejects their claims to valid holy orders, and that, of course, would invalidate their claims to having a valid Holy Eucharist, because you can't have a valid Holy Eucharist if you don't have a priest who's validly ordained. It just doesn't happen.
But he did say that they believe that the Eucharist is the body, blood, soul, and divinity.
Oh, sure, yeah. That's their claim, anyway, but it doesn't mean it's true.
Okay.
Jehovah's Witnesses truly believe that Jesus isn't God, and they'll point to Bible verses that purport to show that, but it doesn't make it true. So I'm not saying this to be offensive or to be pugnacious, but just simply to say that you should not receive communion there because it's not a valid Holy Eucharist. No matter what they may say about it, it's not a valid Holy Eucharist. And we'll get a link posted to that statement by Pope Leo XIII. So if you want to read his reasons for saying why Anglican holy orders are null and void, you can take it from the Pope's own authority. Now, as a little footnote here, it is true, nonetheless, that sometimes it's happened where, realizing that their holy orders are invalid, that they will find a renegade Orthodox bishop or a renegade ex-Catholic bishop or somebody who does have valid Episcopal holy orders and get ordained by that person. So maybe in a given situation, you might have a man who managed to wangle his way into getting validly ordained by a consecrator who had valid holy orders as a bishop. But that may be valid, but it's terribly illicit. So it doesn't really help their situation any. But that's a little subnote. So as far as his claim is concerned, St. Peter did not establish the church. Jesus established the church. That's the key to remember in a conversation with him. Jesus established his church. Now, his church was planted, if we want to use that term, by the apostles and by other apostolic men, St. Timothy, for example, Titus. These are men who were not apostles, but they were counted among the disciples of the apostles, and they planted the churches that we know of today in cities like Alexandria and in Constantinople and Antioch, although Antioch's not really much of a city center anymore, Corinth. All of the New Testament books in which St. Paul is writing to the church in these different places, these were all centers of the church that Christ established that had been planted in these various city centers. So this is why you see certain churches tracing their lineage back to one of the apostles, for example. In India, the Catholics in Kerala, in southern India, they trace their lineage as Catholics back to St. Thomas the Apostle, Doubting Thomas. And he went as far as India to plant the church. He established the church there. He was martyred there. And the precious memory of his apostolic witness going back 2,000 years is venerated to this day. So part of this man's confusion is to think that there are these multiple valid churches that are somehow independent of one another. No, that's absolutely not true. Jesus established one church, that is the Catholic Church, capital C. Now, that church is expressed or experienced or present in these various localities in different ways. So it's the same church, but it will use a different language in one locality. So to use Aramaic, to use the language of Kerala in India, to use the language of Greek in the case of the Greek Orthodox Church. And so these are not different churches, and they're certainly not like valid unto themselves. The only validity that any church would have would be if it was in union with the Catholic Church, the church that Christ himself established. So if that church went into heresy or schism or both, then that church would be cut off from the life of the church universal. And we saw that happen in the Arian heresy, for example. So a little bit of historical background, I think, can help to clarify these misconceptions that he has. And he may be entirely innocent because maybe that's all he knows. But as far as you're concerned, Bernice, just know that A, you shouldn't receive communion in that church because it's not a valid Eucharist. B, what he's telling you historically is simply not true. And C, if anything, You should be evangelizing him. I don't know if it's in the cards for you to do that, but he should be coming to the Catholic Church. And that would be the long and the short of that. Now, if I had been there talking to him, we might have had a somewhat different conversation, but I could understand why it would be confusing to you.
Well, he quoted the book of Revelation, chapter 1.
Mm-hmm. The different churches?
Verse 11, I think. Something about that there are seven churches and that it was back in like 1033, 1034, I can't remember the exact year, that he said, I'm so sorry.
I can tell you what he said.
I
can tell you what he said, Bernice. He told you that the Catholic Church broke away from the true church, the Orthodox Church, and that these churches remained faithful to tradition in Constantinople, in Alexandria, in these various other ancient sees, and the Catholic Church hived off onto its own, and that these are the churches that continue to preserve tradition the way it was before that break, or something along those lines. It's probably what he told you, right?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. So and that's he said that the Catholic Church really isn't, that the Pope is not actually the Pope of all that, and I was getting, sadly, I get very emotional because I love my faith. I love being Catholic, and I love all of the precepts of the Catholic faith. And so I didn't argue the point. I asked him for a pamphlet, and he said he would email it to me. I guess it just started questions in my head about how many churches were founded by Jesus' initial apostles, and are all of those considered Catholic? And
let me restate it. Go ahead and finish your question, though. Sorry to interrupt you.
Well, I just want to know. I want to be able to receive the Holy Eucharist properly. I never want I don't want to go somewhere and disrespect God.
Right. That's my biggest. This is admirable that you have that view, Bernice, and I want to support you. You have a good Catholic instinct there. So the first bit of advice would be I would stay away from this place because it's basically just a Protestant church. It's a branch of the Church of England. It's not an historic church. They sort of style themselves in that vein, with vestments and a liturgy, and you know they call themselves apostolic, and they believe they have a patriarch and all of these things. But all of it traces back to the Church of England, not to the ancient church. So the Coptic Church, the Coptic Orthodox Church, that is a valid church. It's a real church, but it's a part of the Catholic Church that went into schism, as did the Greeks and the Russians and the Bulgarians and the Armenians and all the various other Orthodox churches that split from the Catholic Church. They will tell you the Catholic Church left them, but in reality, it was they who left the Catholic Church. So let me do this, only because this is a very broad topic, but it's worth your time to delve into it further. If you have a pen handy, I'd like to recommend a book that I think you'll find very helpful.
I do.
Okay, actually two books.
Okay,
the first book is called Jesus, Peter, and the Keys. Jesus, Peter, and the Keys. And that's by David Hess and the other co-authors.
I'm sorry, the last name is David what?
Hess. H-E-S-S.
Okay.
That book is a compendium of quotations from the church fathers that run to the better part of 800 years. From the time of the apostles forward, demonstrating that especially in the Eastern lands that we think of now as the Eastern Orthodox churches, they recognized and appealed to the authority of the Bishop of Rome as something more than merely, as the Latin phrase goes, primus inter pares, which in Latin means first among equals. This is what you'll be told. Well, the Bishop of Rome, he's just first among equals. He has no special jurisdiction. He has no special authority. That's absolutely not true, and it's provable as being false by looking at what the major church fathers, East and West, but primarily Eastern church fathers and patriarchs, what did they say all those years ago about the Bishop of Rome? So it's utterly false to claim that the Bishop of Rome does not have and did not have a unique jurisdiction and a special authority, and this book will demonstrate it. The second book I'd recommend, and I have to take a break, so forgive my abrupt departure, but the second book I'd recommend, Bernice, is called Ending the Byzantine Greek Schism. Ending the Byzantine Greek Schism. And it was written by the late, what's his first name? Lycoudas. Jim Lycoudas, L-I-K-O-U-D-I-S. He was a convert from Greek Orthodoxy, and he became a Catholic. And he wrote this book to explain to his Greek Orthodox friends why he became Catholic. Very helpful. Thanks, Bernice, and I appreciate your call very much. I'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149.
You got it.
That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Well, a little news for your good-to-know file, if you're interested. This is from the New York Post. A series of unseen sketches drawn by Dr. Seuss will be edited by an inclusive group of writers and artists from diverse racial backgrounds before they are published for the first time. The news, which has already spawned accusations of woke washing on social media, was announced just a few days ago by Dr. Seuss Enterprises, a company founded by the family of the famous children's book author, whose real name was Theodore Seuss Geisel. He died in 1991. The sketches will serve as the basis for a new line of books that will be written and illustrated by the group and follows his recent cancellation after six of his children's books were yanked from publication because of alleged racist imagery. Now, a new set of up-and-coming authors and illustrators are set to create inclusive storylines inspired by the drawings with the aim to represent a diverse cross-section of racial backgrounds to represent as many families as possible. This according to reps for Dr. Seuss's company, Dr. Seuss Enterprises. Meanwhile, the books will be published in a new Seuss Studios series to be aimed at readers from ages 4 to 8. The first two titles are going to hit the shelves of bookstores next year. The CEO...
I will not read that in a car. I will not read that in a bar. I will not read this here or there. I will not read those anywhere. Ooh. Dr. Seuss is so ridiculous, Patrick.
It is, if you ask me. Well,
do
one person
like green eggs and ham? I do not like them, Sam.
How
I am.
Dare,
I do not like green eggs and ham. Would you like them here
racist.
Or there? I would not like them here or there. I would not like them anywhere. Yeah, I do not like green
not
eggs
cool,
and
Dr.
ham.
Seuss.
I do not like them, Sam. I am.
No, I bet you don't. So dumb.
I just was watching you have fun with that.
Oh, this one makes me so mad.
Someone
I
on
love
Twitter,
Dr. Seuss. It's like saying Mr. Rogers is racist. It's ridiculous. This aggression will not stand.
I agree. I think a certain George H.W. Bush said that once. The news attracted backlash on Twitter, with one person writing, "Can't they just make up their own woke stories without ruining the work of a beloved author?"
Thank you.
It was bad enough that they canceled his books. So that's happening.
And you know what? They didn't cancel his books because they're still in homes all across the world, and they're still being read. Just ridiculous. It's so ridiculous. Sorry.
How do you really feel about this?
Yeah, sorry. This one makes me hot.
I touched a nerve.
You did. I'm a very big fan of Dr. Seuss. Loved him as a kid. I loved reading him to my children. I loved his anti-war stance. He was blatantly anti-racist in his books. Just look at The Stars on Mars. I mean, these are great stories. Yertle the Turtle. The list goes on and on. His popular ones aren't even his best.
Mm-hmm.
This guy's great. Go check him out. Read them while you can.
The new titles, If I Ran the Zoo, And to think that I saw it on Mulberry Street.
Oh, you know why that one's racist? Because it says there's a Chinese man eating with sticks.
Chopsticks?
Yeah. That's racist.
If I go to a Chinese restaurant, I use chopsticks.
Maybe, can you enlighten me why that's racist?
It's not. That's the whole thing. As you know. But anyway, there, you know, to the extent that there was anything in the stuff that he wrote, keep in mind, I mean, his first book came out in 1950. It doesn't excuse, I mean, if it's something that is truly offensive, it doesn't excuse it, nor do I mean to suggest that we should excuse it. But at the same time, I can't help but thinking of somebody like Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens, his pen name Mark Twain, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer, not to mention the other works that he wrote back in those days. These were written depicting the times in the United States in rural Missouri along the Mississippi River prior to the Civil War. And he captured the words and the cadences of the ways people spoke and how they were in those days. It's almost like a photograph using words of what it was like in those days, because that's where he lived in those days. And people want to cancel Mark Twain because they don't like the fact that he captured, in the terminology, including the N-word, he captured the terminology as it was used at that time. Their being offended goes so far that they want to just simply obliterate him and not even let the kids read Tom Sawyer,
yep,
for example.
Yeah.
Here's an interesting story. I want to tell you something just interesting before I forget, because I'm prone to forgetting. Take The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. The hero of that story is Jim, the black man. He is like the one person who is good and kind and loyal and faithful and brave, and far from portraying a black man in a negative light, Mark Twain goes out of his way, it seems, to make Jim the hero of the story. You know, kind of like he was like the sidekick in a way, I guess, to Huckleberry Finn. But all the white people in the story are conniving, or they're unfaithful, or they are greedy, or there's some other problem with them. It's like the one person that you can really count on when things get difficult is the black character, Jim. And they want to eliminate that from the libraries. Wrongheaded, if you ask me. Okay, Cyrus, go.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. What happened to, if we don't learn from history, we're doomed to repeat it?
I've heard that before.
Yeah.
So, yeah. The problem is, you can learn from history, so you're not doomed to repeat it, but you're stuck with all the other people who didn't learn from history, who are going to cause us to have to repeat history. That's the problem. Anyway, I just wanted you to know, because I know that you're a Dr. Seuss fan. This is also some news here, just on the same front. Authorin Lucy Foster, she was the first black student at the University of Alabama. She died just a few days ago at the age of 92. She had no desire, according to the New York Times article, to be a civil rights pioneer. Growing up as the youngest of 10 children in an Alabama farm family, she simply wanted to get the best education her state could offer. She obtained a bachelor's degree in English from the historically black Miles College in Fairfield, Alabama in 1952. But then, though she was a reserved, even shy person, she took a daring step. She applied for entrance to her state's flagship educational institution, the University of Alabama, and she was accepted, at least until university officials discovered that she was black. Once they found that out, they told her they had made a mistake and that she was not accepted to the school and she would not be welcome. So began a legal fight that culminated in 1956, nearly 2 years after the Supreme Court found segregation in public schools and colleges unconstitutional in the landmark Brown versus Board of Education decision. But her quest to obtain a second undergraduate degree in library science lasted only 3 days, when mobs threatened her life and pelted her with rocks, eggs, rotten produce. The university suspended her, ostensibly for her own safety. Several weeks later, it expelled her because she was black. Her case was the first to test the Supreme Court's decree giving federal district judges the authority to implement the Brown decision, and she was beaten back. But when she died on Wednesday at 92, she was remembered for her courage and dignity in waging a fight that led directly to sustained integration at Alabama 7 years later in the face of Governor Wallace's notorious stand-in-the-schoolhouse-door defiance. I mean, this is a very important story that few people really remember anymore, but it paved the way for a great deal of progress and gains that were made in the civil rights arena. And she was at the very center of it, a brave woman, and she just died, 92 years of age. So if you're interested in that story, it's a rather lengthy article in the New York Times. I thought it was fascinating. And Cyrus will have it posted for you on the show Twitter feed at P. Madrid Show. Let's go to Ryan in Arizona. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, good morning. How are you guys? Quick question. I just need some dad advice from you. I've been on something called Exodus 90 just to prep myself for Lent. And I have three young boys, 10, 8, and 6. And I was speaking with them yesterday, like, all right, tomorrow's Friday. Let's give up meat, as those Catholics do. And they were all kind of like, what? Why? So I understand the biblical basis, and I'm just looking for advice. How would be the best way to kind of explain this to my kids and then get them enthusiastic about it?
Yeah, good question. Well, you might want to talk to them. How old did you say the boys were?
10, 8, and 6.
Okay, so they're little guys. So maybe you could try it this way. Say, hey, guys, what would happen if somebody just any time he felt even the least bit hungry, or even if he wasn't hungry, he just wanted food, what would happen to somebody if he just ate food anytime he wanted to? And they'll probably, you know, come up with some different ideas, but one of them's going to say he'll get fat. And you say, exactly. And then you could say, if somebody gets too fat, if they get too big, is it healthy for them? And they'll say, no, it's not healthy. Okay? So think of it that way, guys, that in life, your body especially has certain appetites. Like, you know how when sometimes we have to get up early on a school day and it's still dark out and you don't want to get out of bed, you just want to keep sleeping? Well, that's your body's appetite for sleep. You want to sleep. Your body is saying, let me sleep. But you know that you have to push yourself and get out of bed and get dressed and get to school, because going to school is more important than sleeping. Okay? You follow me so far, Ryan?
I am.
Okay.
It's making a lot of sense.
Okay, great. So in other words, what I would suggest is that you establish in their minds kind of the cause and effect between not always doing the thing that you want to do or that your appetite is demanding that you do, whether it's food or sleep. And you don't have to go at their age. You don't have to go into other appetites that we have. They'll find out about that in a few years. But in the meantime, I think just sleep and food are probably enough that they can understand that there are times when it's better to do without that. It's a good thing to eat food, but it's a good idea to avoid food, even at times when your body is saying, give me food, feed me, as in the Little Shop of Horrors, as the plant says, feed me. So our appetites are like that. So maybe if you talk to them about how part of becoming a man, and for your daughters, part of becoming a woman, part of growing up is to learn how to master your appetites. Because your appetites, if you don't master them, they will master you. And it can wreck your health. It can kill you. If you allow your appetites to rule you, you won't live a happy life and you won't live a long life. So Lent and fasting from food, like Jesus did, you could tell them before he started his public ministry. It's so that
awesome.
It helped.
There's the God door.
Yeah, there's the God door. In other words, Jesus did that for 40 days. He didn't have to, because Jesus being God, he was holy, but he had a human body. He has a human body, but you know, in that historical context, he had a human body that was hungry and wanted to sleep and wanted to drink water, etc. So even Jesus emphasize this mastery over his appetites by fasting in the desert for 40 days. So this is why we do that, guys, so that we can be more like Jesus, so that we can not be controlled by our bodily appetites and become holy. I would put it in those terms and have whatever else you might want to add, but I think that might get through to them.
Well, Patrick, I appreciate it. It's a great day to be Catholic, and honestly, that seems like it'd be a good short children's book. Maybe you should consider it, because something I would definitely buy.
Well, thank you. I mean, who knows? I think I have a few more books left in me. I've written 28 so far, or 27, I forget which, and that may be another one. You never know, and I'll have to give you credit if I do that, Ryan. Thank you. Talk to them about how the athletes who want to win championship football games, they have to work hard and run and sweat, and it's painful, and it, you know, it's not fun, but they do it because if they don't do it, they won't win championship football games. It's kind of like that. I'll be right back.
Connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
I can't hear this song without picturing Jim Carrey and...
throwing their necks out. Chris Kattan. Yeah, and...
the guy from Elf. What's his name?
Oh, is it Will Ferrell?
Yeah, Will Ferrell.
All right.
I can't not see that. All right. By the way, Republican Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds signed a bill yesterday banning biological males from women's sports. Did you hear about that, Cyrus?
I sure did.
Check it out. Reynolds said in a statement, "This is a victory for girls' sports in Iowa. No amount of talent, training, or effort can make up for the natural physical advantages males have over females. It's simply a reality of human biology. Forcing females to compete against males is the opposite of inclusivity, and it's absolutely unfair. This makes Iowa the 11th state in the country." I mean, it's sad that there are only 11, but maybe we'll get to all 50 eventually. "It makes Iowa the 11th state in the nation to ban biological males from women's sports. The bill protects, or the new law rather, protects girls' sports programs at every school level in Iowa, including in high school and in college sports. Student athletes must participate in sports based on the biological sex listed on their birth certificate, according to the new law. The bill also requires schools to designate sporting events as either co-ed or male or female. The governor's office said no student will be prevented from playing a sport that matches his or her biological sex or a sport designated as co-ed. Now, as you might imagine, far-left, crazy, fringy groups, they immediately reacted with condemnation.
They're not happy.
Oh, no. No, they'll never be happy until they control everything. So the president of GLAAD says state elected officials need to stop targeting trans youth and their families. As a parent, my heart goes out to all the young people in Iowa who were just cruelly kicked out of school sports by the unjustified law. No, they weren't kicked out of anything. They were just directed to the proper teams that comport with their biological sex. That's how it works, man.
Yeah, there was that other story of the dad who lost custody of his little kid because he wouldn't allow them to surgically mutilate
right
their body, and the mom was all for it, and he went and spoke at a school. Did you see that story?
Yep.
And people, yep. The kids in the classroom were all...
the fury.
Yeah, they're all... I can't even play what they were chanting. I can't even say... No. I can't even allude to what they were saying, chanting at this father. It was so foul.
Let's put it this way. It was a lot of bad words.
Yeah.
That'd be a fair rendition. Now, this is not the same story, but it just a little bit of insight into the left... the far left, the fringy left, the extreme screamers on the left, the superintendent of a Michigan public school cost taxpayers over $700,000 in salary and benefits amid calls for his resignation after he admitted to spying on parents' social media accounts. This is from the Daily Caller. Community school superintendent Robert Shaner admitted to monitoring social media posts made by parents and contacting at least two employers of said parents and one police department over parents' posts, according to a February 15th deposition that was reported in the Detroit News. Parents are calling for his resignation amid the spying allegations. Shaner said, "Yeah, we value the input of all parents, and we certainly want to keep our thumb on the pulse of the community. So we monitor social media very closely on all fronts and make sure we're responsive to the community." No, you don't. What you're doing is you're looking for ways to retaliate against parents who disagree with your crazy policies. Shaner made $293,492 in salary, according to Michigan's government salary database, also costing the district an additional $437,409 in benefits, His taxpayer-funded salary outpaces superintendents in neighboring areas that serve even more populous student bodies. So he's you know, altogether, all told, making about $700,000 a year. Rochester Community Schools serve approximately 15,000 students, according to U.S. News, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Shaner drew the ire of community members after parent Elena D'Inverno filed a lawsuit against him. The lawsuit alleges that Shaner curbed D'Inverno's right to free speech after she started two Facebook groups, RCS Parents for In-Person Education and Conservative Parents for Rochester. Both pages advocated for in-person learning amid the coronavirus pandemic. That's really outrageous, Cyrus, isn't it? That here's a parent who says, I would just like my child to be in the classroom, learning with the other students. So she sued him because she alleges that she lost her job because he was monitoring her Facebook posts and he got in touch with her employer and he, the allegation anyway, is that he lied to her employer about what she was doing and said that she was threatening the school district. So he managed to get her fired from her job.
What a great guy.
Yeah.
It's so great having people like that in the world that are constantly looking at what other people are doing and just waiting for a chance to rat them out.
They're out there. They walk among us. 888-914-9149. How about Kevin in Park City, Utah? Good morning, Kevin.
Hey, how are you, Pat?
Doing well, thank you.
Excellent. Hey, just a quick question. You know, I'm going to be visiting my niece out in Chicago, and I was just wondering, she was baptized Catholic, but not a practicing Catholic now. She's living with her boyfriend. Is there any sin at all in staying with them when they're living in that particular situation?
That's a real kind of gray area question, and there's nothing inherently sinful. Let's look at it this way, first of all. When you evaluate a moral act, you want to look at the three foundations, or as the moral theologians say, the fonts of the moral act. The first is the act itself. Is there anything about this act that is in itself sinful and thus should be avoided? The second one would be your intention. Is there anything about your intention of doing this that could be sinful? And then the third font or the third foundation would be the circumstances. Is there anything about the circumstances that would make this sinful? So if you evaluate a scenario like this one and you run it through these three different things, more often than not, almost always at least, you can know pretty quickly whether or not you should do something or should avoid doing something. So let's apply it to this scenario. So you've got a couple who's cohabiting, and are either of them previously married, or is this just a case of straight fornication?
Yeah, straight fornication.
Okay. So objectively, that's sinful. And if you're going to be visiting with them because you're in town, and it'll save you money from having to stay in a hotel, I'm presuming that's probably why you'd want to do that. Is there anything sinful about staying at somebody's home? Well, no. There's nothing sinful about that. I mean, there's nothing inherently problematic about staying in someone's home. What's your intention? I presume, tell me if I'm wrong, that it's because these are your friends, you'd like to see them, this is the easiest way to see them, and it will save you a couple $100 so you don't have to stay at a hotel room. Is that
correct?
Right? Okay. Well, there's nothing inherently wrong there. And what about the circumstances? Would your being at this place under these circumstances, would it either give scandal to somebody, or could it suggest that you condone their circumstances? Or would there be some other situation? Maybe you're putting yourself into a near occasion of sin. Would the circumstances be such that you could say, well, under these circumstances, I shouldn't do this? How would you evaluate that?
Yeah, I wouldn't think that any of those things would apply to me based upon my faith and such, but obviously there would be that slight concern of, would it look like that I am in agreeance to the way in which they are living? And that would be the one thing that would bother me, supporting
right.
that indirectly.
Right. Right. And it should bother you. That's your conscience speaking to you. So when I said it's kind of a gray area, what I mean is it's not easy to determine you know, the magnitude of something like this. But that third category is where I would find a problem with it. In other words, if there were a blizzard and the only place you could stay was with them, this cohabiting unmarried couple, then the circumstances are fine because you don't really have a choice.
Yeah,
you
got it.
Get out of the elements. Okay. But in a situation like this, presuming that there isn't some compelling reason why you would have to stay there, I would be concerned if I were you about giving scandal on the one hand, but also about the danger of giving them a kind of tacit impression that you approve, or at least you don't think there's anything wrong with their situation. So for me, that third category is where I would probably pull the plug.
Okay, that's great. That just adds a lot of clarification to what I already knew, but just needed to hear from someone else.
I understand. No, we all need that, don't we?
Okay.
Okay, yeah, well, thank you, Kevin. Thank you very much. 888-914-9149. How about Anita in Tinley Park, Illinois? Good morning, Anita.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call. I
sure.
just have a question, a little brief background here. I believe in submitting to the authority of the magisterium and have been through an annulment 37 years ago. But my question is, when did the church start issuing the declaration of nullity? And are you aware of any saint that may have gone through an annulment and, you know, had a marriage, died in that state as well? And, you know, here the church is declaring that individual a saint. You know, my question, I guess, goes around in a circle because, Patrick, in the beginning, I did not know my faith. And I would hear of my actions as being a Catholic divorce. And then I felt like I was actually caught in a bit of a perpetual sin until I began to grow in faith and understand the authority of the church. So with all that in mind, wondered if you knew when they started issuing declarations of nullity and if there was a saint that may have died.
Okay. I don't know the answer to either question, but I don't think it'd be difficult to find out. So the declaration of nullity and the process that leads up to that is a canonical or a law issue. So it would be best answered by a canon lawyer. Kathy Caridi is a canon lawyer, and I'm trying to remember the name of her website. Her last name is Caridi. And oh, there it is. It's called Canon Law Made Easy. I would suggest that you do a little word search to see on her website. She has a search bar there if she already has an article on that topic. But she's very interactive with her readers, and I would think that if you were to send her a note and ask her the question, she's very likely to give you an answer, you know, that would be substantive.
Okay.
So canon law.
C-O-R-I.
Her name is Caridi, Caridi. Canon Law Made Easy is the name, or .com is the name of the website. Now, as far as canonized saints, that's another one. I just don't know. There may well be, but I don't know. I'm thinking about Saint Rita of Cascia. She's not somebody who had an annulment, but she had a terrible marriage and a real jerk of a husband, and she wound up becoming a canonized saint. But I don't think this deals with the issue of an annulment. So check out Kathy Caridi's website. I wouldn't be surprised if she gives you an answer. And if she does, ask her to post it on her blog so that I can read it too. Then I'll be prepared for the next time the question comes up. Okay, we have another hour to go. It'll be the last hour of the day, but you can call 888-914-9149. We'll get you on the air with your comment or question. I'll be right back.